Mr. Jewett, Reel 21. You've worked out how many Russian convoys in total that you are on, Mr. Jewett?
Yes, I checked with the World Shipping Society to get quite sure of my facts, and they very kindly sent me a printout. And the total number of convoys which I took on the Ashanti was 11. I took 11 on the Ashanti, and then when I left the Ashanti, went to another destroyer, HMS Vigilant, which took 12. So in total, I took 23 convoys altogether. So I escorted. And of course, as I've told you, they were close. They were what they call fighting escort convoys. You know, we were close in, not covering force. So that's it. I don't know quite.
When you mentioned that you joined the Vigilant, I forgot to ask about its size and its armoury and so forth. Could you tell me about
that? Yeah, sure. You must remember, I'd come off a tribal class destroyer, which was the Ashanti, which had 6 4.7s in twin mountings and a twin 4-inch plus, and her tonnage was just over 1,800 tons, nearly 2,000 tons. She was a big, fast, with a speed of 36 knots, set down speed. So she was a very, very fast ship indeed. You know, the pride of the fleet were the tribals. So I went on to the the Vigilant, which was a much smaller vessel. She was fitted with single 4.5s. She wasn't as powerful as the tribal class. She was a fleet class destroyer nonetheless, but she had four single mountains, two forward, two aft, but she had a Bofors gun, which is an excellent gun, with the very latest Hazemir mounting on the with a range finder on the Vigilant, which was. And she was also very fast. I think their laid down speed was about 36 knots, or 34 knots, slightly slower than the tribals, but not much in it. And they were classified as fleet class destroyers. Because when you come down the scale to the Hunt class, you've got the Hunt class destroyers, which are only about 1,000 tons. But in each of these destroyers were so useful in their own rights, you see, because a fleet class destroyer has a high seaboard, and if you remember, I told you that in the Russian convoys we couldn't pick up survivors because of the high seaboard, whereas a Hunt class destroyer has got a low seaboard, much lower seaboard. You could reach down and pull them out, so practically, you see, which is a very different thing, which you couldn't do on a bigger destroyer. But it's all a question of scale, because these are destroyers. But when you come to the smallest light cruisers that there were, was the ship I was on, was the Phoebe, and she was 5,000 tons. I mean, they're, to a destroyer man, they're big ships, you know, if you know what I mean. It's all a question of comparison and scale, and sailors are like that. They're very, very proud to be on ships. Originally, destroyer men, such as myself, were paid what is known as hard layer money. They were given, I think it was an extra sixpence a day, which was a lot of money for the rough, for having to rough it. It was like the submarine service. It's so tough and so rough. You've got no facilities whatever, practically no facilities. That the original V's and W's of the First World War, they were paid hard layers. I think it's hard layers money, I can't remember. But we never got that, because we had all the facilities, all mod cons on these modern destroyers. They're destroyers, but not the same, not as rough as the original chaps were.
Another point I'd like to raise with you: when you were going into action, what kind of preparation was going on in case of being hit and fires breaking out prior to going in? You must have prepared for it.
Absolutely. The Royal Navy, I don't think the Royal Navy can be bettered anywhere for efficiency. That includes the German Navy. Because as a peacetimer, and I'm thinking of peacetime complement, you had drills every day. You had forms of drills every day. Ships went out on firing practices. The ordnance staff, they set all the settings on the gun mountings and the turrets and the directors to the absolute nth degree, so that the accuracy was phenomenal. Of course, in every ship and every destroyer that I was on, in gunnery, you had to compensate for the difference of angles. For example, it's fairly obvious that if you have a ship, especially a large ship, with a turret at the front of the ship, the fore part of the ship, and an X or Y turret at the after part of the ship, there's an angle, and that angle varies. You see, that angle varies as the inclination of the ship to the enemy, and that's all got to be calculated. It's not just a sort of blasting off, pointing at the enemy and blasting off. All those angles are minutely calculated, and also the preparation, hands to clean guns every day in harbour. Every day the guns are checked, pulled through, polished, checked, set. And likewise, range takers would go and set their range finders. And no doubt, although I wasn't a radar man, they called it RDF actually in my day, but a radar man, that all their settings would be checked as well. They would have systems of checking. For example, on the rangefinder, we used to have ranging masts, and you had a map. So when you're at Scapa, and all the ranging marks, you knew exactly which anchorage you were at, and you knew exactly to the yard how far that ranging mast was from the ship. So you could set your rangefinder to that yard. Now the nominal, the optimum firing position for a destroyer, and I think for a lot of ships as well, was, to my knowledge, to 5,000 yards. At 5,000 yards, everything on the ship was absolutely bang on. It was perfect. That was a perfect range for opening fire, because your gunnery was spot on. But the range varied, say, to 7,000, 8,000 yards, or even less, to 3,000, you got slight variations, which you had to put right with spotting corrections, what they call spotting corrections, which was what Lord Bowen used to do. He's a marvellous spotting officer. They'd have spotting corrections. If the fall of shot from the enemy fell to the left, he would say, first of all, they'd have to get it in line. And he'd say, right five, and he'd put it, and then spot the correct route. Right five, and then up ladder shoot, or zigzag shoot, which is up, down. But they'd have to get the line first. Once they got the line, and once she was in your line of sight, she was a dead duck normally, because those shells which fell in front of the enemy invariably ricocheted anyway, so you'd get a hit even though it looked like a miss. It sometimes wasn't. But those behind the enemy you could see, so you could down ladder, and you'd eventually, by spotting, the control officer, the gunnery control officer, would show. But the whilst all this was going on, this was done very, very frequently. There was and for damage as well. Everybody knew what to do if you were hit, or if the part of the ship was hit. Everybody had their job to do in the ship's company, no matter what it was. And that was, well, at least they were on the Ashanti. The Vigilant wasn't quite as efficient as the Ashanti that way, I regret to say, although very, very efficient and very, 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 very good indeed. But you've got to remember, as I said before, some of these kids had been bank clerks 6 weeks before. You couldn't expect professionalism of the high order that was on the Ashanti.
What about preparations? You know, you're going into action. You're at sea. You're going into action. What about preparations for the wounded and for fires that may break out? Did they bring forward fire buckets or?
No. Well, one of the things which I'll tell you an amusing story. When you get to learn your ship, you take particularly going to notice that on each gun deck, there are hoses. They're not hoses, they're sort of little hose sockets coming out of the deck. And they're opened up when you go to sea. And the reason is because, and I said, well, actually, what are those for? Well, I'll tell you what they're for, is because, and it sounds terrible, but it's true, that if the gun gets hit and there's wounded, then the blood and gore is very slippery, and especially with men in sea boots and the guns trained round and the ship's rolling, so this opens the seacocks, and it allows the seawater to flood over the gun deck to wash away all the stomach and the gizzards and all the rest of it, which could be splattered all over the place. That's one thing, one example. The other thing is, of course, that it's a bit rudiment. We only had two ratings on board who were really, we didn't have any morphine, anything like that. It was just every man for himself in a way, provided you had clean underwear. That was one of the things they used to do, clean underwear. We always went into action with, into battle. We always had clean underwear on for obvious reasons for their cleanliness. But apart from that, it was, I'm afraid, a lot of every man for himself. We didn't know much about first aid. Fire control, yes, because most of us went for fire control drills in fire control, learning to keep under smoke and that sort of thing. And that, but in the main, not a great deal. It's you know, that couldn't happen to us attitude, I'm afraid, because we were.
What about precautions for a hit that may set the ship on fire?
Oh, well, on the cruiser Phoebe, I had. They had what they called damage control parties, and they were people who were at every point, fixed point, you had hoses. You had hoses at certain points, which everybody knew where they were. Then, and it was the one who grabbed the hose first was the one who got fighting the fire with whatever happens. And that's that. But on the cruisers and above, you have special on, because you don't have chippies on that on destroyers. Not you might have one, but that's about all if you're lucky on a big destroyer, shipwrights and things like that. But on a cruiser, you've got a whole teams of what they call damage control party. That was my first action station, if you recall. That was the messenger, you know, DCHQ messenger.
Right. Come back now to D-Day again. You're in this Army Corporation role, and we have mentioned the fact that there were naval officers on land with the troops.
That's
acting
right.
As observers, gun observers.
That's right. The Army Corporation people. Now, I wasn't part of the team, at least I wasn't a conscious part of the team, but I was actually, because all the destroyers there had what they call grid references and grids, and there was a system where you, if the Army contacted the naval authorities that wanted supporting fire to a certain area, that you couldn't actually see what you were firing at. You just elevated and trained the gun to the point to the points which supposed to, according to the grid and the position you were in, according to the grid, and let fly, and then you bombarded. But they would send back, and I wasn't in the communication. I wasn't in that side of it. I was a range taker, so I think I told you. I wasn't in that side of it. But what happened was that they would spot in much the same way as I've described war at sea. They would spot. There was up 1,000, down 1,000, you know, left or right or whatever you see, and left four, whatever, and that would be set. They would set, and then once they got the range, it might have been a wood, you see, with some German tanks in, and once you got the range, well, of course, then it was rapid fire, what they call rapid salvos, and used to knock the stuffing out of it. So I think the Army might. Well, I wasn't that end of it, but I should imagine the Army were very, very grateful for the support that we could give them in the Navy, up to a limited range, up to say 5 miles inland, sort of thing, which is quite a lot of D-Day.
Communication by radio from the
officer? I think it was. I wasn't in communication. I wasn't in the control party. That would be the control, the gunner control officer who would have that, you see, in the DCT. But I wasn't in that.
It wasn't through to him.
That's right. It wouldn't come through to me, you see. So that, if you appreciate, but there would be immediate communication. Same as they would with all the big ships, you know, the big battleships did just the same. I mean, they pulverized areas, you know, with their walloping great big guns and that. But we were quite handy as well, you know. If you get hit with a 4.7 or a 4.5 inch shell, you know you wouldn't want it for breakfast, I can tell you.
Was it pretty constant firing during the day, 6th of June?
On the 6th of June? No, actually. What happened was, it was that there was a barrage. I think I meant to describe the barrage. When the RAF there was a barrage.
The phosphorus
bombs. And then we went in and we all had set targets. And there was a fairly constant barrage for, going from memory now, you know, about half an hour or three quarters of an hour before the troops went in, because you've got to remember that you've got to be very careful when your own troops, because I had a grandstand sit. I mean, I wasn't doing a thing. I was just looking at them through my range finder, which was a wonderful thing, and I sort of had a grandstand view of the Trank landing crafts and the lads going up onto the beach there, you know, where that big house was, you know, sort of, and I was right there.
I think you said that there was no enemy fire coming back at you.
No, I didn't see any, because we wouldn't see it. I mean, if it was close range fire, like machine gun fire, I wouldn't see it from where I was, you know. I was too far out. I wasn't that far out, but too far for to be able to spot minutiae, even with the range rangefinder, I couldn't see that closely, you know, what machine gun fire. But I think it varied, from what I gather from history books and that, it varied along the coast. Some had terrible resistance and some didn't. But the point, when I saw them, the TLCs and that, and I saw these for the first time, I'd never seen them before, I saw these rockets and I was wondering, I thought, good God, what are they? Like a TLC, and they were going up close inland. And they were letting fire these rockets. They were terrifying things. They were really great things. They were on our side, fortunately. But good grief. Yeah, that was the first time I saw those things. They were letting these dozens and dozens of rockets off there.
When this bombardment opened up, as you said, which was on a given time, when opened up the ships.
Yeah, when hell let loose of us.
It must have been pretty intense.
It was. Oh, it was a, you know, everybody's on. Well, it's the same as any action. Once you fire the first shot, you know, it's all over. You relax. So I suppose it's like going on the stage or anything like that. Once you get over the initial part of it, you've got too much to do. Fear goes out the window. You're not really frightened. You're more frightened, I think, of these things, of what might happen, you know, in anything, you know, when you go, you know, apprehension, I think, is a better word than fear. I don't think it's fear. You're just apprehensive, you know, But on Russian convoys where we were, there was no hope. We knew that it was just, you had to stay afloat.
Was it the heaviest bombardment you'd experienced to date?
No, it wasn't. No, the heaviest bombardment I have experienced in the war was a combined bombardment of Cape Bon in North Africa when the Eighth Army and the First Army sort of joined up at Cape Bon, and the German army were bottled up in Cape Bon.
We've got the fleet. Actually.
Yeah, that's right. And that was the heaviest one in my memory.
And as I say, we've just established you didn't see at least any incoming fire. I was thinking more about artillery fire than machine gun fire.
No, I couldn't see any machine gun fire. No, I couldn't see any from where I was. I didn't witness it.
But how long
but
were
it
you?
Obviously, happened. You know, must have.
How
been.
Long were you there on that coastline?
On the coastline, probably about 3 or 4 days. Well, no longer than that.
Can you the night scenes? Obviously, there's firing still going on. What was the scene
right.
at night? That you
very were just it's. Just very, very, well, it's like a ship in the darkness. Not much happening, if you know what I mean. Although it probably was. I couldn't see anything on a ship. We're at action stations. Not a lot happening in the way of, except everybody keeping on their wits for aircraft and submarines and all sorts of things that might happen. Not what actually did happen, but what could happen, because, as I say, with all those ships of the fleet there, one German submarine could have just about created havoc. I think it was sunk half of them. I mean, not if they'd been, had their wits about them, but it didn't happen. So
was the gun firing from the fleet at night going into the?
I didn't see any. No, I didn't see any. No, I didn't see any at all. But, no, I didn't see any night firing with Starshell and things like that. I can't recall any anyway. If it did happen, it's lost in my times of my memory.
Did you see casualties coming back?
No, I didn't. I didn't see any at all. That was strictly army sort of. That was an army sort of manoeuvre onto the ships, onto the hospital ships and things. But I didn't personally see any. I wasn't that wasn't my scene, as it were. You know, I was. Although, funnily enough, I was literally in the thick of it. I was in the thick of the action. And probably the most successful part of the British part of the beach.
Did you have a feeling of momentous moment in history on this particular?
Oh yeah, we knew it was it. That's true. Everybody knew this. Everybody knew this was history in the making. But to tell you the truth, this is terrible to say this. I don't want to belittle anybody else, but for me personally, it wasn't as bad as some of the other things. Perhaps by this time I'd become very hard, used to battle. I was battle hardened, you know, and I was used to bombs and shells and machine gun fire and the smell of cordite. By this time I was a pretty hardened, seasoned veteran, and it didn't worry me too much. I believe some of the other lads probably took it in the ship, probably were more emotionally concerned than I was. I wasn't that. I thought, well, it's just another set to this. I've seen it all before.
But at that moment, you're saying these hostilities only people were.
They were cunning.
They were into a good crew. You had a good.
They were a good crew. Oh yes, don't let me decry them. No. I don't want to give that impression. They did wonders. They had to for our very existence. I even had to teach them on the Vigilant how to belay a fender to the guardrail, because they didn't know what a clove hitch was. There were just weird and wonderful hitches that came out of them. But I used to do what I could with them. I was very strict with them, because at a reunion afterwards, my wife did tell you what they said. I was an absolute bastard, but they also thanked me very much for being that. To lick them into shape, because they knew afterwards that I knew more about it than they do. I think
after being there 2 or 3 days, as you said, what happened to you then?
Well, we just came back to, I think we went back to Devonport then. I think we went to Guz, we went back to Guz. It was all over after the first 5 days or so. Might have been five. After the first 5 days of it, it was all over, if you know what I mean. As far as we were concerned, it was, except for some of the big detachments of ship detachments, it was all over by the shouting, as the saying goes. They'd got the bridgehead, the army was moving inland, and it was a question now of just no point in staying there, sort of thing, make the place look untidy, that's all, but that was it.
Did you have a patrolling role, because you still had this enormous fleet of ships?
Oh yes,
stationed there. And
that's right. Oh yes, of course. There was anti-submarine and patrolling role, but not close-up action stations. We weren't actually going into action. It was like defence stations, and as you say, it was a patrol. You're quite right. That did happen in the Channel, because the Channel was a very, very tricky place I think it was tricky to avoid a collision, actually, let alone anything else. But yes, of course, all destroyers do that all the time, and ASDS sweeps, and submarines, destroyer screen sweeps, and the whole flotilla. You're part of a flotilla, you're not an independent like a big ship. You're part
How
of
many
a flotilla.
Ships might be in a flotilla?
Or 7 or 8, actually. Yeah. Vigilant, Verulam, Virago, they were all the V's and W's.
And what did you become involved in after this D-Day?
Now, after D-Day, for me personally, as far as I can recall, was the last... That was in 1944, wasn't it? That's right. That was the last... the D-Day action was the last action I took place in, took part in. From then on, I went back to... I went back to barracks because... I was a professional sailor, and I had applied to for a higher gunnery rate, what they called a higher gunnery. I was a leading seaman, and I wanted a higher gunnery rate, and I also wanted to qualify professionally for petty officer, because I was a killick, you see. So I actually got drafted back to Chatham Barracks. And when I got to Chatham Barracks, they were very good as they were. I took my higher gunnery rate, became a control rating, second class.
And what does that involve when you say high gunnery rate?
Oh, you go to the gunnery school for about 6 weeks, and you do all their tests and all their exams. You pass exams, and you all their tests, and you either pass or fail. They don't mess about in the gunnery school at Chatham. You either made it or you didn't.
And what were the tests and exams based on? What kind of elements were there in those tests?
Oh, they're superb. For example, range taking, which was my speciality in fire control, they have what they call riper platforms, and that simulates the role. It's roll, yaw, pitch. Roll. I'm trying to think what RYPA riper platform. Roll, yaw, and pitch, and of a ship, and you're on. And when you go onto the platform. It jerks and it throws you all over the place. It's a simulated ship. It's like being on a ship. And they had several of these in the gunnery school. I mean, you not just one or two. You didn't take your turn. They had several of them for various courses going through. And you take examinations, and you've got to learn how to maintain your test. I mean, you test your range finder. For example, you have rhodium-ion mirrors, which you put on each side for ranging on the moon. So, because the moon is infinity, you see, so you knew that and it's all a question of measuring an angle. You know, the parallax angle between the enemy and yourself, which can be done with right down to yards. And all that sort of thing you learn to do in your. So, and also at that time, they put me on a 3 weeks examination course for petty officer. So it took 3 weeks for me to take my petty officer's examination in Chatham Barracks.